I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, Bob Ferguson has been bragging on the campaign trail that he is protecting communities from sexually violent predators, except an expose from the Seattle Times shows he's actually doing the exact opposite. Plus, Kamala Harris floats a plan that would destroy the middle class. The question is, will voters fall for it? And if you were hoping to get a free abortion outside the DNC, well, sorry, Planned Parenthood is all booked up. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Happy DNC week, everyone. We'll talk a little bit about the DNC coming up later in National. I've got to start by going backwards a little bit. So about a year and a half ago on this show, the key issue that we were trying to raise awareness for, trying to help community members fight back against, was the release of sexually violent predators into communities from McNeil Island. If you're not familiar with Washington State, we put the worst of the worst sex offenders on an island, and we keep them there unless they're able to successfully petition to get off the island. I think that's appropriate. I mean, it almost sounds like something a deep red state would do is like throw the worst of the worst on an island. And in a deep blue state like Washington, they decided that's what they wanted to do with sex offenders who were deemed irredeemable, essentially, where they would be, you know, diagnosed and they'd have individuals talk to them and you know, from a medical, mental perspective, say this person, if they are released into the community, they will hurt someone again. They will rape someone again. They will abuse a child again. And so we put them on an island and we keep them there. And look, I care about budgets. I care about good fiscal policy and taxpayer responsibility. I care about all of those things. But I'll tell you what, there's really not a price too high for me to keep a violent sex offender, child abuser on an island. Hell, $1 million a year, fine. If that's going to stop that person from raping another woman, if that's going to stop that person from raping another child, genuinely, I don't care. The amount of crap this state wastes money on, like, I don't care if it's costing $500,000 a year to keep that person on an island and away from the public. So about a year and a half ago, there was this issue that started to creep up of communities being blindsided with the release of sexually violent predators into their backyards without any notification, without any ability for a community to say, hey, we have some concerns. You know, this person's going to be living in what's called a LRA, a less restrictive alternative. So they're going to get off the island. They're going to be in basically a glorified house. And they're going to be 50 yards away from a school bus stop where my kids wait for the school bus. Yeah, I think I ought to know about that. And I think I ought to, as a parent, have a little concern about that. So there were two communities who stood up and fought back. And they stood up for themselves when no one else would. One of them was Enumclaw, because they had, you know, released to their community of a guy who was going to be just yards from a school bus stop. They were understandably very concerned about it. So they raised holy hell. They ended up getting representatives from the state to come to their community for a community meeting where this was said to them.
The onus of keeping your kids safe is on you. You need to talk to your kids. You need to open a dialogue with your children.
It was one of the most stunning things I'd ever heard. Parents who were so upset, so fearful that one of the worst of the worst sex offenders, so bad they had to be put on an island, had been released into their community with no community notice. And that when they asked state leaders, representatives who were involved in that release to come in front of them and explain what was going on, they were told, well, the onus is on you to protect your kids from pedophiles. So we had Enumclaw fighting back, and then the fight went to Tenino, where there was going to be the opening of an LRA, one of these less restrictive alternatives, on the outskirts of town in Little Tenino, where, again, they felt like they were blindsided by it. They felt like there was absolutely no plan to monitor these individuals who would be sent to the LRA. There was no plan to be able to have, I mean, the county didn't have enough staffing at the sheriff's office to guarantee that they could get a rapid response if there was some sort of issue at this LRA. And every step of the way, these Tenino parents who, oh my God, gave me so much hope for our community because they were like, we are going to fight. The media is not paying attention to us. Most lawmakers aren't paying attention to us, but we don't care because we are going to get this LRA scrapped. That's how hard we're going to fight. And I mean, you had Governor Inslee fighting against them tooth and nail. Even when they managed to get some lawmakers to put forward a reasonable bill that would say, okay, you can release these dangerous sex offenders into our community, but let's at least establish a little more community notice for people. Like, that was asking so much. And Governor Inslee, what did he do? He came back and he told them that it would be unduly burdensome for the state to have to notify all these communities in the way they wanted to be notified. At the time, one of the parents who was behind these efforts in Tenino, Sarah Fox, she was on our show regularly.
We're not going to give up. This just shows that the community has to watch for each other's backs and that our governor does not care about public safety. He's more concerned about criminals' rights. He's more concerned about meeting the needs of the criminal, the sexually violent predators, more than the taxpayers themselves. And that's disheartening.
And I'll tell you what, you know, one of the things that there's a lot of, you know, government misfeasance, malfeasance, incompetence, all of these things. There's a lot, and there has been for the last 3 years, a lot of stuff going on to try to help out violent criminals and just screw over the law abiding. But one of the things I think for us that really made us focus so hard on this story for so long is the passion and determination of those parents to fight like hell when no one was standing up to them, with them, to fight with them. Very few people. It's one of the reasons we picked up their story. It's one of the reasons whenever they wanted a platform, they had a platform on this show. And those parents in Tenino, the governor be damned, Democrats be damned, they fought back so hard, they made so much noise that they were eventually successful. And that house never became a less restrictive alternative for these violent sex offenders. And Nicole and I and a couple of the very few state lawmakers, Representative Travis Couture, Representative Dan Griffey on the Republican side, we went down and we celebrated with them in Tenino. We celebrated all the hard work they put in. We celebrated how much they pushed to get that facility scrapped. And we celebrated the fact that they were able to do it without the media giving a damn, and they were able to do it without most Democrats giving a damn, without the governor giving a damn, without the attorney general giving a damn, and not just not giving a damn, actively suggesting that they were overreacting, that, you know, the state was doing the right thing. The state wasn't trying to spring these sex offenders on communities, and this was just a bunch of right wing, whatever it is, just throwing a fit over nothing. And to me, I was so proud of them, like both in Enumclaw and Tenino. I was so proud of them having this whole ecosystem working to shut them out and shut them up for them to stand up anyway and be like, no, we know we're right. We know this is crazy. We know that these violent sex offenders shouldn't be thrown in our neighborhoods without us having a say. So we're going to keep speaking out. We're going to keep trying to draw attention to this issue. So that was a year and a half ago. They had some success, but they did not have legislative success. You know, Couture and Rep Griffey, they tried really hard to try to get some bills passed that would improve this situation. And there was a little progress, but certainly not enough. And part of that was because all of the people pushing against this were just vilified as like right wing, Looney Tunes, like, oh, these sex offenders have to go somewhere. You're just NIMBYs. You just don't want them in your backyard, but you want to put them in other people's backyard, et cetera, et cetera. So fast forward a year and a half after all that fighting, all that pushing back with little credit for these parents, for the absolute badass backbone of these parents. And what do we freaking see over the weekend? But a long investigative report from the Seattle Times backing up every single freaking concern that those parents had. A story that came a year and a half too late. Well, not too late. I'll get to that. I don't think it's ever too late. But a story that proves that the parents in Enumclaw, the parents in Tenino, everyone who fought back against these releases and these predators being pushed on communities, every single one of them were right. And the government was wrong. And the government continues to be wrong. And so, hell, this Seattle Times reporting, it's a year and a half too late. I really wish that those parents would have had the weight of the Seattle Times, you know, the Democrat obsession over the Seattle Times on their side a year and a half ago. I think it would have made things a hell of a lot easier. And it would have actually led to significant policy changes. But a year and a half later, that's fine. I want to go over some of the Seattle Times findings. The headline, WA confined hundreds for sexual violence, then it quietly began releasing them. So before I get to this quote, I'm just going to warn you, you know, if you've been a victim of sexual violence, this might be disturbing for you to listen to. So I want to give you a moment to tune out if depictions of sexual violence are just not something you want to listen to today. So take a moment to tune out if that is your decision. But I think it's really important for me to read the beginning of this Seattle Times investigation, because again, it paints a horrifying picture, but a predictable picture of what can happen when you take someone who's been deemed irredeemable, who was put on an island to protect the community from them, and you decide against warnings to release them into communities. So again, for those of you who wanted to tune out, now I'm going to proceed with the beginning of the Seattle Times investigation. It reads, just before midnight, Paul Harrell drove to a stranger's home near a riverside town in Maryland. He found the basement door unlocked and, taking a paring knife from the kitchen, entered the bedroom. A 74-year-old woman awoke with Harrell's hands constricting her throat and the weight of his body on top of her. It was a crime that echoed how Harrell had raped women and girls decades earlier on Washington's Whidbey Island, and one that Washington spent years and millions of dollars to prevent. It was not an anomaly. One in four people the state has committed and released from the nation's first program to rehabilitate so-called sexually violent predators have been arrested for new crimes, a Seattle Times investigation found. One in seven, like Harrell, reoffended in a serious manner. Half involved sexual violence. So here you have a horrifying instance of someone who was on McNeil Island, was released from McNeil Island, ended up going all the way across the country and committing a crime very similar to the crimes that landed him on McNeil Island in the first place. And according to the Seattle Times' own investigation, one in four individuals released from McNeil Island have recommitted crimes. One in seven of them have been serious crimes, like the types of crimes that they were convicted of in the first place. But this next part is, I think, what's truly horrifying and what was the basis for the concerns and the fears that these parents had. It says DSHS, the Department of Social and Health Services, and the Attorney General's office stated in 2019 that Harrell had been successfully treated for his history of sexual violence, and they agreed to his release, despite concerns by a corrections officer that his compliance with supervision appeared to be deteriorating in the months prior, including lying to his therapist. So this guy, who was released from McNeil Island, who the Attorney General's office, DSHS agreed, had been successfully treated for his history of sexual violence. He gets off McNeil Island. He goes to Maryland. He goes into a 74-year-old woman's home while she's asleep with a paring knife, and he gets up on top of her. Clearly not successfully treated, as the Attorney General's office and DSHS had proclaimed when they agreed that he should be let off McNeil Island and back into the population. Again, a perfect illustration of why these parents were so fearful about the sexually violent predators being released in their backyards. Now, I want to go into a little more of this Seattle Times story. I think it's important. And again, I applaud the Seattle Times for looking into this. It sounds like they spent an awful lot of time doing this research. Maybe they started the story around the time that we were on the air show after show after show trying to talk about the dangers and the concerns with this issue. One of the things I'm concerned about, though, is they're not placing the blame on anyone for this. There is no mea culpa. There is no, the state was wrong, these parents were right. And I think the parents deserve that. Let me read a little bit more from the Seattle Times story for you. Unlike other behavioral health treatment programs run by the state, the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island has no regular independent audits or enforceable state or federal standards for the quality or efficacy of its care. DSHS's per-person cost for the program currently averages $440,000, making it one of the state's most expensive forms of institutionalization. But the agency has not examined whether its 34-year experiment in civil commitment is helping the people in its custody or the public. The lack of scrutiny by DSHS and lawmakers has allowed the state the convenience of saying the money and time it spends treating residents works, without the responsibility of looking at what happens off the island. Yet, Washington continues to send a small number of people to McNeil Island each year while rapidly releasing many more, according to the Seattle Times data analysis. Today, more people the state once labeled sexually violent predators live off the island than remain on it. So one of the things the Seattle Times found and why it required more of an investigative report is the state doesn't track these individuals. There was no consistent, reliable state tracking for what happened when one of these sexually violent predators was released from the island into the community. The Seattle Times had to dig up data and dig into these cases to find out that one in four of them committed crimes after their release, that one in seven committed serious offenses. And the state, basically what the state is saying is, well, if we don't track it, we're not responsible for it. Like, oh, we're hands off, you know, they have a constitutional right to petition for their release. They were able to petition for it successfully because apparently the Attorney General's office and DSHS has a really low bar for what successful treatment looks like. And then they're going to go off into our communities and, hey, not our problem if they reoffend. It's bound to happen. But when I say the Seattle Times fails to place blame on this, and really I think that there should be a mea culpa across the board for these parents who were ignored, who were vilified, et cetera, et cetera. This entire article, long, lengthy investigative report, there's one big thing missing from it. It does not mention Bob Ferguson by name one time. One time. The Attorney General's office is the state entity tasked with confining people to civil commitment on McNeil Island and tasked with reviewing requests to have them taken off McNeil Island. The Attorney General's office and Bob Ferguson's office is the entity that is the make or break on these decisions. Yes, there's a judge involved. But if the Attorney General's office decides not to dispute it, then that person gets off the island. Or they can fight it tooth and nail. But in the case of that man who broke into a 74-year-old woman's home in Maryland with a knife and got on top of her, they thought, oh, he's successfully treated. Even though a guard at McNeil, who arguably was around that individual much more often, said he's not complying with anything. He's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. How can you say that he's fit for release? That doesn't make any sense. We know better in the Attorney General's office. The entire Seattle Times story, not one mention by name of the Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who wants to be the next governor, whose job it is to keep dangerous people confined to McNeil Island. And one of the reasons why that really pisses me off is because in the last few months, just in the last few months, Bob Ferguson has on multiple occasions in his campaign for governor bragged about protecting communities from these sexually violent predators. Yes, he actually brags about the wonderful work he's doing protecting these communities from sexually violent predators when he knows damn well that more of them have been released than have come onto McNeil Island. And that one in four of them are out in the community committing new crimes. Yet he has the audacity, because the media lets him get away with it, to say, oh, I'm the one out there fighting for these communities, even though he was ignoring their concerns a year and a half ago. I'm the one out there protecting communities from sexually violent predators, even though he knows damn well that his office is just saying, meh, go ahead, back in the community. Go ahead. Oh, warning signs you might reoffend? No big deal. We think you've been successfully treated. I couldn't even find, I wasn't even going to go through the hours of effort to find every tweet from his campaign account or his official account where he's been sending out statements bragging about his work protecting the community from sexually violent predators. On his website, it says, Bob is standing up for survivors of violent crime. Bob kept nearly 100 of the most violent sex predators out of our communities. No mention at all about all the sex predators who they let into our communities, of course. Just a few tweets attacking his opponent, Dave Reichert. Dave, let's be real. I protect consumers and protect criminals. I protect consumers and prosecute criminals and sex predators. He tweeted, I've kept close to 100 of the most violent sex predators out of our communities. He went on to attack a plan Dave Reichert had to put the homeless on McNeil Island. He said that that would result in sending the sexually violent predators that my legal team is keeping detained there into our communities. This man has the audacity to suggest that he is protecting communities from sexually violent predators when he knows damn well how many sexually violent predators his office has allowed, without any pushback, to go back into communities, to reoffend, to commit other crimes. And look, I expect it out of a politician. I expect it from someone like Bob Ferguson, who is just desperate and hungry for power. I expect it. But to have all of that easily accessible in the last few weeks, over the last few months, him bragging about it, elect me governor, I protect communities from predators, I protect communities from predators, to have him doing that so blatantly. And the Seattle Times, at the exact same time, working on a story where they know that's not true. They know that's not true. There are multiple examples. And then for them to release this story and not one time mention Bob Ferguson by name, explain that to me. Explain that to me. Explain to me why they wouldn't look at the person who has been bragging about his work on this, who is the attorney general, whose office is tasked with protecting the community from these people, who's running to be the freaking governor of Washington State. Explain me why they wouldn't mention his name one damn time. That's why these things are allowed to happen. That's why parents in Enumclaw and Tenino had to go it alone. That's why they had to fight back on their own, because the media just doesn't care. Sure, they did a good investigative report. Sure, they tracked down some information about these sexually violent predators, but they didn't do the most important thing that the media is supposed to do, and that's hold powerful people accountable. And right now, on this issue, the most powerful person who has his hands on it is Bob Ferguson. And he wants to be the next governor, and you're giving him a free pass. And your readership is arguably the readership that needs to hear about this the most, that needs to know that he's campaigning on a house of cards. His campaign is built on lies. He has the audacity to say he's protecting people when he's doing the exact opposite. For the love of God, Seattle Times, remember why you got into journalism. Remember the power and the influence that you have, and ask yourself why you are so adverse to holding this man accountable. Ask yourselves, had you held him accountable before? Could you have prevented crimes? Could you have prevented releases? Had you been asking these questions all along? Had you listened to the parents in Tenino? Had you listened to the parents in Enumclaw? Could we have revealed some of this sooner? And again, I'll give them credit for doing it in the first place. Not like I went out and dug out those numbers, so I give them credit for that. But you have to take your job seriously to hold powerful people accountable. And months from an election for governor, you're letting him off scot-free on such a critical issue. I mean, that's embarrassing. That's shameful. Do we really have to continue to be the ones to do it? My friend Jason Rantz put out an article over the weekend saying, media, are you ever going to call out Bob Ferguson for his lies? And I responded and I said, no, they're not. Unfortunately, no, they're not. Apparently, it's only conservative media that can do that. Coming from a journalism background, oh my God, it drives me nuts. And so I highly recommend reaching out to the Seattle Times today, politely, sternly, asking them, why did you not feel like it was necessary to mention the things Bob Ferguson said just weeks ago on the campaign trail, that your own article proves are false, that your own article proves are misleading statements from a candidate for governor? I highly recommend doing that. Now, I had to, of course, reach out to some individuals who did care a year and a half ago, when communities were fighting back against this. On the show tomorrow, we're going to have on State Representative Travis Couture, who was one of the champions for those parents in Olympia. I do want to make sure he gets credit. As much as most lawmakers just shut them out, he started fighting for them, and he has not stopped fighting for them. So he's going to be on the show with us tomorrow. But I had to ask Sarah Fox, again, one of the Tenino parents who was responsible for that huge victory down there, to come back on the show today to respond to that Seattle Times reporting. Sarah, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Brandy.
I want to see if your reaction was similar to mine. I mean, you see this big expose come out from the Seattle Times talking about, you know, that at least 25% of these individuals released go on to commit crimes. 1 in 7 are particularly serious crimes. So when you saw that after everything you fought against, what was your response?
My initial reaction was I was not surprised. Unfortunately, we went through this last year in Tenino with the sexually violent predators dealing with the less restrictive alternatives. But I wasn't surprised by DSHS and DOC and this policy board with this decision. I say I wasn't surprised, but it made my blood boil, because it comes down to these people are in our backyard still.
Yeah, and I think my response, because I thought of you immediately, and I thought of the other parents in Tenino, and then I thought of the parents in Enumclaw. And maybe this is just me misremembering, but man, I feel like you guys fought tooth and nail, basically with very little assistance, you know, a few lawmakers who were in your corner, and were by and large ignored. Is that a fair interpretation?
I think that's an accurate interpretation. We had no support from the government. Actually, right now, I requested public disclosure requests from DOC, and I still have not received my full installment. So that makes me wonder, what are they hiding? Representative Travis Couture hopped on and was a huge help, but you're absolutely right. We got zero support.
Well, and I would argue also from the media, frankly, and I could be wrong. I don't remember any big stories in the Seattle Times sharing the concerns of community members. Maybe you remember some. I just don't. There were a few media stories. But it feels like now this is just justifying everything you guys fought against. So I guess there's a little silver lining there, that like at least there's a justification that you guys weren't overreacting.
Right. And I think a lot of the media stories downplayed it. They used acronyms without even explaining what SVP was or an LRA was. And a lot of the media would describe this as like a rehabilitation home. Like, sexually violent predators cannot be rehabilitated. They are staying in that home for the rest of their life until they die. So they downplayed the severity of what's going on in the community, and they're going to reoffend.
Why do you think now, it looks like, and I'll give the Seattle, like, I'd rather late than never, right? I think the Seattle Times pointing these issues out is actually going to be helpful in getting some bipartisan solutions to bills that haven't gained traction over the last 2 years. But what do you think it is that, if you had to guess, spurred them to come out with this now?
You know, I don't know exactly what spurred them. When I read the article from the Seattle Times, it was accurate. The statistics were great and they were alarming. But I also, when I read that, it all boils down to money. Because when I read that DSHS doesn't track these people when they are released, it's absolutely alarming to me. So, you know, I don't know what spurred it, Brandy. I don't know if, I really don't know, but I'm glad it's back on the radar, because yeah, this is problem.
I felt kind of dumb that I didn't know that. I was not aware that the state of Washington was under no requirement to track the sexually violent predators who are released from the island. Is that the first you'd learned about that too, that there was no tracking system?
There was no tracking system. Yeah, we did know that there was no tracking system when we did our history and learned about this last year. And, you know, if there's no tracking system, it's a free for all. And learning that once these sexually violent predators are out in the community, we have for-profit companies that are making a lot of money off of these sexually violent predators. And I read in the article from the Seattle Times that he said that, you know, he goes to restaurants and his children goes to restaurants and these people are also at restaurants. And that just made my skin crawl, because if I'm sitting at a restaurant with my family and children, knowing that someone next to me did a heinous crime, absolutely not. And I don't think the restaurants want to know that either.
Yeah, that's Keith DeVoe, who's the CEO of the Special Commitment Center. But it reminds me a lot of the comment made to Enumclaw parents when there was, you know, the community demanded a meeting and they've got the interested parties in front of them. And they're told, while they're so fearful of what's going on, that you're responsible for the safety of your kids. As we now know, you were releasing violent predators into your communities that we're not going to track, that we know have a 1 in 4 chance of reoffending or committing new crimes. So just it boiled your blood. And it does to me, too, just remembering how you guys were treated and talked down to and acted like this isn't a problem. And, you know, you mentioned Keith DeVoe saying, oh, well, you know, it's not a big deal. I go out to eat with my family, too. And so what if there's a, you know, violent rapist who was once considered so dangerous they had to be put on an island away from everybody else? I hate to make this political because I really don't think that this should be a political issue, but the reality is there's one party in power. Did you notice that Bob Ferguson's name was never mentioned once in this article?
Absolutely. That's the first thing that I thought of.
I read it once through and then I said, wait a second. And I used my search function and I thought, there is no way. And I would just ask you about that because he has been on the campaign trail for governor, bragging about protecting communities from these sexually violent predators, about fighting for communities in court to make sure people stay civilly committed, et cetera. And now here we're finding out that's not the case at all, that so many of them have been quietly released. So I guess, how does that strike you about what Bob Ferguson's saying on the campaign trail versus the reality?
The reality is public safety is not his concern. Is him getting in the office is his concern, and getting the votes is his concern. If public safety really was a concern, this would not have been under the rug for the past year that we've been fighting for. It's embarrassing. It's absolutely embarrassing. And shame on him for not thinking of the victims. Everybody in government is talking about what we need to do for these sexually violent predators and where they're going to live and how we're going to do all these great things for them. But who is advocating for us as community members and taxpayers, and who's advocating for the victims?
Yeah.
So it is.
Oh, go ahead.
It's very political.
Yeah. What do you make of the Seattle Times not mentioning what he's been saying on the campaign trail?
Doesn't surprise me, actually. That's why I said I was actually surprised this was a very well-written article. Usually I don't read things from the Seattle Times because they leave details out on purpose. And I wonder if that's what they did here, but I do like the facts that they did present. But if you've got the attorney general not mentioned in this article, I kind of went, why?
I agree, because it seems very obvious. He's bragging about it, that this is going really well, and he's protecting communities, except this is what our data found. So that's something we're definitely going to be pointing to. But let's look at maybe a positive from this. So it's one thing for, you know, all those right-wing stupid parents in Tenino and Enumclaw to be fighting for this stuff, dumb hick hillbillies, whatever it is, and for us right-wing podcasters to point it out, and right-wing representatives, but now the Seattle Times is acknowledging this is a problem. So do you think that changes the course of momentum on fixing some of the issues you're concerned with?
I don't think it's going to 100%. I mean, the further north we go, the more liberal it's going to get. I believe Seattle might welcome these SVPs in their community. You know, let's help them get jobs. Let's help them do good work. Absolutely not. I don't agree with that 100%. So I will stick with being a hillbilly down in Tenino because I know my community is safe, and that's what it's about.
Hell, the hillbillies fight harder than anyone. You're not a hillbilly, obviously, but I'm just putting myself in the mindset of the Seattle Times and what they probably think of you and Bob Ferguson. So that's what I can imagine. Well, Sarah, look, better late than never. I'm glad that a lot of this information is coming out. I share your sentiments that the Seattle Times did some good digging here. I hope their follow-up includes the name Bob Ferguson in it, though. So, Sarah, keep fighting, as I know you will.
All right. Thanks, Brandy.
Yeah. I mean, and I have a lot of frustration for Sarah, for the families who were fighting about it a year and a half ago. You know, I hope there's some positive change from here. But to me, again, the big thing, we knew the system was a mess. You know, the Seattle Times didn't tell us anything we didn't already know about the danger of releasing someone who'd been deemed irredeemable out into the community. They were able to put numbers on it, and that's helpful. But I don't necessarily think we needed numbers to tell us that our concerns a year and a half ago were valid. And so I'm really hoping the Seattle Times, even though, you know, their ed board has endorsed Bob Ferguson for governor, despite, you know, all the problems with him as a candidate, I hope they are willing to circle back and say, hey, you've said all of this stuff. It doesn't align with what we're finding. So explain yourself. Is that really asking too much? I don't think it is. All right, we're going to continue on with this topic in our next segment, because as we speak about this, there is a board that's just met, scheduled to meet again in a month to determine what to do with sex offenders in our state, how long they ought to remain on community custody. And I think this next story is an example of, you know, some of these decisions and some of these bills that are introduced that have to do with protecting people from violent predators. They're never thought through. Nobody thinks things through. They just, oh, that sounds good. Let's just introduce a bill about it. And this is just a prime example of that. All right, first, coming up this weekend, Natchez RV Resort is going to be entering its phase two rollout. They've got a grand opening phase two pricing this weekend, August 24th and 25th. 18 extra large RV lots starting at just $79,900. And so they did phase one. Even some undivided viewers and listeners bought in at phase one. And the place is just completely beautiful. I mean, first class amenities. They just opened their 4,300 square foot luxury clubhouse. It's absolutely stunning. And it's for owners who have lots out there. So you can enjoy this space. You can have family over and enjoy this space. They've got a great room, indoor, outdoor fireplace. It's an entertainer's dream, gourmet kitchen, fitness center, showers, laundry, and they're just finishing up their pool and hot tub. Outside, they've got pickleball courts, playground, dog park, miles of recreational trails, and there's wine tasting. Everything you could want is right nearby. So don't miss out on phase two grand opening pricing coming up this weekend, August 24th and 25th. 18 extra large RV lots starting at just $79,900. You can check it out, NatchezRVResort.com. That's NatchezRVResort.com. And the only rule, if you buy a lot, Nicole and I demand an invitation. Thank you very much. It's only fair. It's really only fair. All right, so continuing on with this issue of sexually violent predators, so not every sex offender in the state of Washington winds up on McNeil Island. So there are some who they do their time for their crime in the state prison system, and then they are released into communities because they're not deemed irredeemable at that juncture. However, there are still some pretty serious community custody requirements for them. And we know that, right? Sex offenders have community custody requirements, you know, register as a sex offender, can't do this, can't do that, got to check in. And so I will give it to the state. On paper, the state treats sex offenses very seriously. On paper. The question is, are they being treated seriously in practice? And will the state continue down a path that began in the legislative session in 2024, earlier this year, to try to ease post-release requirements for even the sex offenders who are deemed at the highest risk of reoffending? This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. You can hear a lot about some of the public safety issues that we talk about on the show, and certainly that Future 42 is interested in at future42.org. All right, so on August 15th, and again, this is happening simultaneously, you know, on the backdrop of the Seattle Times reporting, but it has to do with the same subject. So on August 15th, there was a meeting of basically the state advisory board on sex offenders. So, you know, they'll have meetings, they'll discuss, you know, current requirements for sex offenders, McNeil Island, whatever it is. And they have a board of people that meets and makes all these determinations. So they met on August 15th, which I'll get to in a moment. But it's important to understand kind of the system of how our state manages sex offenders post-incarceration. So as you know, there's three levels of sex offenders, level one, level two, level three. So one is considered to have the lowest risk of reoffending, and then level two, a little more moderate risk of reoffending, and then level three sex offenders are considered to be at the highest risk to reoffend. So there's these requirements for these sex offenders, depending on the level of their classification, once they're released from prison, and it'll determine on how long they stay on community custody. Now, Washington State is one of the only states in the nation where there are certain sex offenders that have lifetime community custody. They will always be, or supposed to always be, on the radar of the state of Washington for the rest of their natural lives. It does not matter if, you know, they're out and they've got 50 years of life ahead of them and they never reoffend. They might be on community custody in that sense for the rest of their lives. Washington State is one of the only states where that's an option. Well, this past legislative session, Democrats wanted to ease those restrictions. We talked about it on the show. It just, you know, I think was folded into this long list of pro-criminal policies that were baffling to us, that the legislature was focusing on them. Like, here we have these high crime rates. We have a bunch of issues with, you know, policing levels, a bunch of issues with violent crime. And here you've got lawmakers in a short legislative session bothering to introduce bills to make life easier for violent sex offenders. It was bewildering, but one of the things being discussed now, you could look at it as a positive, but I can't look at it as a positive, because now suddenly they are reevaluating whether some of the changes being pushed in Olympia are really a good thing. And I'll, let me read this Center Square article for you, and I'll explain what I mean by I can't look at this as a good thing. So the headline, Washington may alter stance, ending lifetime supervision for highest risk sex offenders. In January, during the legislative session, House Committee on Community Safety, Justice, and Reentry Chair Roger Goodman, a Democrat from Kirkland, introduced House Bill 2178 to allow level 2 and 3 sex offenders to petition to be discharged from lifetime community custody after a certain amount of time. The bill advanced from Goodman's committee, but ultimately failed to reach the House floor for a vote. Now, we talked about this at the time, what a crazy dangerous bill that was for the guy who's in charge of the Safety, Justice, and Reentry Chair or Committee. But then it has this line. Now the Sex Offender Policy Board, which recommended allowing a person to end lifetime community custody, is taking another look at whether it's an idea the board should continue to support. Now think about this for a second. So the board supported this. The Sex Offender Policy Board supported this idea of allowing level 2, level 3 sex offenders who've been put on lifetime community custody to petition to have that ended early. So Roger Goodman, chair of essentially the House Public Safety Committee, introduced a bill to do just that. Thankfully, it didn't get enough votes to be able to move forward. But now, fast forward not 6 months, the committee that made those recommendations that led to that bill in the first place, now they're having second thoughts about it. Now they're thinking, well, is that really such a good idea? To which I would say, shouldn't you have thought it through before it got to the point where a bill was introduced on it? Let me continue reading from the Center Square. This is a quote from Brad Mayhew, who's the chair of this sex offender board. He says, and he said, this is a quote from the August 15th meeting. The foundational question that we have to ask is whether or not there should be a change in state law at all. And keep in mind, he not only like supported this idea, he testified in favor of this House bill during the public hearing just earlier this year. And now he's saying, we have to ask ourselves whether we should even have a change in state law. He said that, this is from the Center Square, noting their prior recommendations on allowing individuals to end lifetime community custody, Mayhew told colleagues that, quote, we didn't have the time to do the deep dive we've done this time into a lot of the issues that are raised by this proposal. And I think that we're doing a more deliberate process now. He said, we also didn't quite have as broad number of people at the table. The recommendation we made perhaps wasn't as fleshed out as it could have been. So that brings us back to this. So I guess that the first question is, do we make this recommendation or is there evidence to support the continued use of lifetime supervision? Let that sink in for a second. So the guy who is the head of this Sex Offender Policy Board, which made the recommendation supporting the ability to get off lifetime community custody, which the chair of the House Public Safety Committee turned into a bill and introduced, which managed to get out of that committee, but failed to advance to the House floor for a vote, thank God. a bill this guy testified on behalf of just a few months ago. Now he's saying, well, we didn't really flesh out that proposal very well. And honestly, we didn't have enough people at the table. We didn't have a broad base with different opinions on it. And we really haven't answered all the questions that come up. So why the hell did you suggest doing it in the first place? So why the hell did you go to Olympia and testify in a committee, in a public hearing, that you're in favor of it, if you're saying just a few months later that you didn't even do the due diligence to figure out if it was a good idea? And we're talking about violent sex offenders. And this is indicative of so many of the pro-criminal policies that we've seen pushed through Olympia in the last 5 years. They don't think it through. They don't care, just like they didn't think through limiting police pursuits. It was such a bad idea, they pushed it through without even giving it a second thought. And then look what happened. And then they had to backtrack, and then citizens had to push an initiative and all of that because they fail to think through what they're doing. They do what feels good in the moment, what will get them headlines, what will please their base. They don't care about the consequences. Oh, look at my bill. And now 6 months later, they're like, well, maybe that wasn't a good idea. I'm going to continue to read on here. Tricia Smith, representing the Office of Crime Advocacy, told the board at its August 15th meeting that, quote, what I'm hearing from our community is that some of the concerns about the way it was presented was the lack of victim voice in the process and just wanting to better understand some of the assessments and determinations for when folks could come off of lifetime supervision. And they note the board's next meeting is scheduled for September 14th. So that doesn't surprise me that you have the Office of Crime Advocacy saying, well, you guys really didn't consider the victim side of things. Democrats in Olympia never consider the victim side of things, or very rarely. Don't want to use hyperbole. Very rarely consider the victim side of things when they push their pro-crime policies. And this is now by their own admission. Oh, we wanted this. We pushed for it. We testified on behalf of it. But now, maybe we should have done our research. You think? Like, isn't that your job to do the research? Isn't it the job of lawmakers to make sure that we actually need a bill, that a bill is necessary, that it's proper, that it's not going to put the community in danger before you turn it into a freaking bill that you introduce and that you have public hearings on? Like, look, I realize that there are some bills that, yeah, public hearings, the committee process and all of that, that's an opportunity to sort of flesh out some of this stuff. But it should be, by the time it gets to bill form, right? By the time it's going for votes, by the time people are testifying for and against it, you should have done a pretty good thorough evaluation process, especially on a public safety related bill, as to what the negative implications would be. And now they're admitting they didn't even do that. So how are we supposed to take seriously any bill that lawmakers introduce in Olympia? Anyone at all, especially on crime? When we have seen time and time again so many examples of poorly thought out bills that help criminals, hurt the law abiding, end up doing exactly what those of us with a brain said that they would do, like with the police pursuit bill. And then all of a sudden 3 years goes by and you've got to try to put the toothpaste back in the tube. The same thing happened with the Blake decision. When the state Supreme Court nullified our state's felony drug possession statute, Democrats took 2 years to say, hey, let's see if we can just decriminalize drugs. Well, that didn't work. Then we found ourselves in the worst overdose crisis we've ever seen in our state. And then they're like, oh, we should put a law back on the books. Because their crazy experiments on public safety don't work. So again, they have that meeting September 14th. Now, at this next meeting, they'll have this Seattle Times report saying, you know, the ones that we send to McNeil Islands and release, 1 in 4 of them are out committing new crimes. 1 in 7 are out committing serious crimes. So I hope that report comes up at their meeting. But also, if they're acknowledging now that they made a mistake, it was premature to suggest there should be a path off community custody for the worst of the worst sex offenders, I really hope that they take the time the second time around and do their due diligence to consider whether that's worth their time, whether that should be a priority of lawmakers in Olympia when we have so many damn things going on related to crime. And maybe, just maybe, next time they want to float a soft on crime policy, they'll remember that they pushed this one forward way too quickly. Absolutely outrageous. All right, that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Okay, coming up next, we're going to get to our segment, Unbelievable. Whew, it's a doozy from the DNC. First, I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. Why? It's free. Why else? Everyone needs insurance, and you should make sure that you have the insurance that you need to cover what you've got, no insurance that you don't need, and that you're getting the best possible price. So many Undivided viewers and listeners have taken the First Mark Challenge and just were shocked by how much money it saved them. Ben and Leslie saved over $1,500 a year. Maggie says that she got recommended a bundle after taking the First Mark Challenge that was half the cost and better coverage of what she was paying. And Casey in Covington says they managed to save his family 37% off their auto quote. So it's like, it's a no-brainer. It's free to do the First Mark Challenge, and then it's free to be a member of the First Mark family. They're taking care of all this for you, and you never pay them a dime. There's a reason I'm a member of the First Mark family. Nicole's a member of the First Mark family. Undivided is insured through First Mark. It's just an exceptional service, and it's free. Again, I just want to underscore it's free. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll whether you're going to watch the DNC this week. We'll get to that, your answers to that coming up in questions and comments. But if you were planning on actually going in person and maybe you were hoping for, I don't know, a free abortion or a vasectomy, well, they were offering that for you. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Oh, God, what do I even do with this story? So first of all, I'm pro-choice. I think that abortions should be rare, but I don't believe the government should unduly regulate them. I support a woman's right to choose up to the point of fetal viability. I also think it's really weird and tacky. I'm going to use their word against them. Really weird and tacky to have a mobile abortion bus outside the DNC. Is that just me? Super strange. So Planned Parenthood Great Rivers, because we got the DNC this week, it's in Chicago, said, here we come, Chicago. Our mobile health clinic will be in the West Loop with the Chicago Abortion Fund and the Wiener Circle, which I assume the Wiener Circle is a restaurant. So I wonder if the Wiener Circle was like teaming up. It's this lady that has like sells hot dogs, but maybe the Wiener Circle is also the name of a vasectomy clinic. But it said August 19th through the 20th. Providing free vasectomies and medicated abortion. EC will also be available for free without an appointment. Reserve your spot here. What is wrong with people? Is that just a weird thing to...
Yes.
Like, I'm all for a woman's right to choose. But, like, pulling up an abortion bus outside the DNC and like celebrating it as this really cool DNC week thing is genuinely unbelievable. But apparently I'm one of the few people who think so, because within like moments they were all booked up. All the appointments were taken. All free vasectomy and medication abortions are filled for our mobile health clinic in Chicago. Check back soon. We will share the interest form link again if we have cancellations. So it took like all of a few hours for the free abortion and vasectomy bus to get booked up outside the DNC. Now, I will also say, at least like some media outlets covered this, the New York Times, free vasectomies and an inflatable IUD, abortion rights advocates hit the DNC. It says this convention is likely to be a head-on display of a new unbridled abortion politics. They'll also have the option of getting a free vasectomy or medication abortion just blocks away. A mobile health center run by Planned Parenthood Great Rivers, which serves much of Missouri and part of Southern Illinois, plans to park itself near the convention and offer those services early next week to anybody who makes an appointment, delegate or not. There's so much interest, the New York Times says, in the vasectomy appointments, I'm told there is already a waiting list. It's a way of showcasing how reproductive health care providers have had to get creative when operating in or near states like Missouri, which borders Illinois and has a near total ban on abortion. I'm speechless. Somebody, if you don't think this is weird, will you get in the comments and tell me why I'm overreacting to this? It's just the tie to the DNC. Again, like, I don't think enough is done from Republicans to paint the Democrat position on abortion as extreme. you know, the Republican position, like if you support any ban, any limits whatsoever, you are an extremist. I mean, look at Bob Ferguson calling Dave Reichert anti-choice. The only quote unquote abortion ban Dave Reichert ever voted on was to ban abortions after 24 weeks. Washington State has a nearly identical ban on abortion. And that's what we need to kind of retort with is Washington State has an abortion ban. Yeah. Did you know that? Did you know that? Tell your neighbors and your friends, did you know Washington State under Democrats has a ban on abortion? Yeah, they ban it after the point of fetal viability. There are only a few states in the nation that have no restrictions on abortion, where you can have abortion like at the point of birth. But Washington State technically has an abortion ban. And, you know, Democrats, for instance, that support no limits on abortion, like that's a pretty extreme position that's out of step with most Americans. Most Americans agree that even if they're pro-choice, that, yeah, you have to, like any medical procedure, medical care, you have to have certain limits and regulations, right? Or else you end up with a crazy, scary, free-for-all medical system. Most Americans, the polling says, don't support late-term abortions. But Republicans don't do a good enough job, adequate job, saying like you can call our whatever bans extreme, but what they're doing is extreme on the other side, and they love abortion so much that they're rolling up mobile clinics so people can just step out of the DNC and get abortions on demand. The vasectomy thing, I don't really care about that, because like a vasectomy isn't, that's your choice to like snip snip and you can't have any more kids. Totally different. Yeah. It's the abortion thing, because we shouldn't be celebrating abortions. That's my whole thing. Like abortions, again, rare, safe, private from the government, private from the internet. Like this whole shout your abortion thing, like that's weird. Don't shout your abortion. The activists out there saying I've had 24 abortions, like I can't wait to get more. It's like, well, you're mentally ill. That's that's very weird. And most Americans agree with this. I think most Americans are like, look, private, keep it to yourself. Do what you need to do within reason. You know, late term abortions, that's extreme. 6-week abortion bans, that's extreme. Like, let's all live in this little sane area in the middle. And maybe the Democrats shouldn't be rolling up abortion buses so women can walk out of the DNC, abort their fetus, and then walk back in the DNC and listen to Kamala Harris speak.
And you are right, because I don't think, I mean, Walz, in his state, abortions are fine up until you, there is no restrictions. Like, there is no restrictions. And have we heard that anywhere other than from people on Twitter? I have not seen that anywhere. Like, this is the extremes that we're dealing with here.
It really is.
It's just wild
to see like some of the people celebrating it online, like, oh, this is an awesome thing. And it's like, is it though?
Yeah. It's sad. You don't have to be religious to think it's sad.
Yeah. So
I think
unbelievable.
That's where we've separated it from anything religion. They want if you bring up religion with it, I think they've made that like a bad thing, right? And so that's another form of another way to attack the right, and we've got to counter that somehow.
You
and
have
saying
to.
There has to be some restrictions. You cannot abort a baby right before it's born,
right? And they want to say, oh, that never happens. Well, there's a lot of like things that are rare, but we still have laws in place to stop them from happening. Like serial killers are rare.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're still like, there's laws on the books for like multiple murders and all that increases penalties. Like, there are a lot of things that are rare, but you have to have some sort of restriction on, because we live in a civilized society, right?
Exactly.
And sorry, like, I don't trust some doctors to say, and even Washington State's law, for instance, I've always said I would never push to change it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is kind of loose. It's the fetal viability in our state law isn't down to the week. So it's up to a doctor's judgment. And I get that, but I think it would be nice to like say, you know, even at 24 weeks, because there's this kind of disagreement about whether fetal viability is like anywhere from 20 to 24. So, okay, let's go the benefit of the doubt. Let's go on the late end of that, but let's put a number somewhere. And then the media should be asking Democrats, hey, do you support abortions after 24 weeks? Do you support a woman's right to choose after 24 weeks? Mm-hmm. Just like they do with every Republican candidate. They're like, where's your stance on abortion? Why don't they ask Democrats, where's your stance on abortion? Because those are two extremes.
Right.
So it's insane. So just really quickly, I'm going to ask Nicole to mute my mic because we had a story pop up in the middle of the show and I need to coordinate with her to make sure that we're ready for it.
I think it's
just ready. Mute me sec. Hold on. Okay, we're good. Nicole, thank you. You do that. We wanted to fit this in today, but we were kind of leery about doing it because we were waiting for confirmation on something. But let me set it up by saying this. Well, actually, let me set it up with a... double dose of unbelievable. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Winging it today. Winging it. So let me set this up by saying, you know, the initiatives that we support, certainly the four of them that are going to be on the ballot in November, these are make or break for some families. You know, and I understand people have strong opinions on both sides, and that's fine. I'm not going to vilify anyone who's going to vote no on the initiatives and has their rationale. In fact, I would never tell anyone how to vote. I'll tell you how I'm going to vote, why I think that voting yes is the best thing to do, some of the lies that have been told about the initiatives, et cetera. But to me, this is about making a choice. This is about, and I think for Let's Go Washington, that's what this is about as well, is saying, here's these policies that have cost you a lot of money, or that are hurting our state economically. So let's put it up to Washington voters to decide whether they want to keep paying these taxes, whether they want to keep paying into programs like long-term care, et cetera. So this is really just about democracy, right? Yay, democracy. So you won't hear me, unless there's a politician who's lying about these policies. That's when I will launch the personal attacks. Because if you're Jay Inslee, if you're State Senator Marco Elias, and you're out there using fear as a method of coercion, especially on the Climate Commitment Act. When you've got the Climate Commitment Act that Jay Inslee's never been able to tell the truth about the impacts to gas prices, to food prices, that bothers me, because you're messing with someone's money, with their paycheck, with their ability to support their family, and the fact that you can't tell the truth about it just makes you unfit for office. I feel the same way about State Senator Marco Elias saying, oh, if you repeal the CCA, then all these transportation projects that are so near and dear and important to your communities, they might have to go away, which is just a blatant lie. It's absolute fear-mongering. So you won't see me engage in personal attacks. Like, I'll call out people who need to be called out for lying to the public. And frankly, any member of the media, even those who don't share their opinion for a living, should be doing that, because they work for you. They're supposed to be looking out for the people and holding powerful people accountable. So let me get to this crazy story that just played out over social media over the last like 24 hours. So Brian Haywood put out a video link. He was at the Seattle Times editorial board to talk about Initiative 2117. So I don't know if the Seattle Times editorial board is going to be pro 2117 on Brian's side of things, or they're going to come out against 2117. But anyway, this is all he did. He put out the link so people could watch the full Seattle Times editorial board conversation. So it was Brian Haywood was there, and also on the other side, Joe Fitzgibbon, state lawmaker, was there making the argument to keep the Climate Commitment Act, etc. So he puts out this video, and he's on the video, right? So people can see him. And he gets this troll that responds to him. I'm going to read the troll's comment. It's from a guy named Robert Knoll, the ex-account Virtuoso Bob. Wow, Joe looks hot. So he's talking about like Joe Fitzgibbon looks hot. Okay. Rachel is smart. That's someone on the anti-initiative side. Brian, you need some blood pressure intervention and to eat less red meat. For being so rich, it's shocking you look so bloated in a public setting. So like, look, I think I get nasty comments all the time, you know, about my looks or whatever it is. And usually that's like, it's just X. It's just the nature of the beast. But Brian noticed something very interesting about this particular account. He looked into who Robert Knoll was. Well, it turns out Robert Knoll works for Puget Sound Energy. Brian said in a tweet, Senior Government Affairs Representative for Puget Sound Energy, Mr. Robert Knoll, weighed in on the Seattle Times editorial board video I posted earlier. Two observations and a question. Observation one, those are some solid, deep political comments. Observation two, sound defense of and great representative of the maintain the hidden gas tax talking points. And three, is this the official stance of Puget Sound Energy? So I think there's a couple of things there. So senior government affairs representative is just a lobbyist. So this guy, and the last time he was registered as an active lobbyist for PSC, according to PDC, looks like 2020-ish. So he's been doing recently lobbying for Puget Sound Energy in Olympia. So there's a couple weird things about his tweet. One, that's pretty bold. When you are a public sector lobbyist, to attack the initiative backer who just put Initiative 2066 on the ballot, which, remember, that would protect natural gas choice. PSC wants to move away from natural gas. They don't want to serve customers natural gas anymore. And Initiative 2066 would let people keep their natural gas. So now you have the lobbyist for PSE attacking by saying he needs blood pressure intervention and to eat less red meat, and he looks so bloated in a public setting. Those are his attacks on Brian Haywood, the backer of 2066. Also, it's kind of weird that you have a public sector lobbyist whose job it is to go down to Olympia and advocate, in this case, on behalf of PSE, who starts off his tweet saying, wow, Joe looks hot. Joe Fitzgibbon, a state lawmaker.
Maybe he was sweaty.
I watched the video. He doesn't look sweaty.
Well, there you go.
And I think he's complimenting the anti-initiative side. Joe mm-hmm. looks hot. What a serious lobbyist you are, Robert Knoll. Oh, Joe looks hot. Like, what is wrong with you? So then I clicked on this guy's profile, right? And I noticed that I actually had him muted. So that tells me that he's a bad troll. Because I rarely block, unless there's like threats of violence or some really grotesque sexual something, I'll block you. But what I prefer to do if you're a horrible troll is I prefer to mute you. You know why? You know why? Because then you think I see your attacks and I don't. And it's beautiful. So I had this guy muted. So that tells me he's been an annoying troll for a long time. I can't really remember the last time I muted someone. And then I looked at his X account, and I am like his favorite thing to tweet about. And his tweets are horrible and disgusting. So these are just a couple in the last few days. This one's on August 8th. I had retweeted something Kamala Harris said where she said, I'm going to be a president for all Americans. And I said, except the weird ones, because I think it's kind of weird that she says she's going to be a president for all Americans, yet they're calling half the populace weird. He said, proudly voting for a rapist and the man who thinks she doesn't have a say in the country's future because she's childless. Pathetic. So he's talking there about the fact that I'm going to vote for the Trump-Vance ticket. And so I'm pathetic because I'm childless. Which is just horrible. What if I was having difficulty conceiving? So he's attacking me because I don't have children. Okay. And then he said to me, your candidate, who is just a couple days ago, who's a walking crime spree, stood in front of billionaires and told them he would give them whatever they want if they give to his campaign. Sit your dollar store Ann Coulter ass down. Which is kind of funny, actually. Mm-hmm. Dollar store Ann Coulter. Like, look, if it was kind of, and I'm assuming I didn't know who he was, right? I didn't know that he's a government affairs and public policy director for Puget Sound Energy. Then I might have responded to him and not muted him and been like, oh, interesting that you represent Puget Sound Energy with these views. Like, look, I'm all for people having their free speech rights on social media, but free speech does not mean freedom from consequence. There are a lot of jobs where you have to mind your P's and your Q's on social media. When I was in TV, I had to mind my P's and Q's on social media. Lawmakers have to do that. Lobbyists should be doing that. Media personalities, anyone who operates in the public space or who operates on behalf of a company and is using their real name. Like, yeah, do you think that Puget Sound Energy wants their lobbyist who has to work in Olympia with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle? Do you think that they want him saying to one of the most consequential political figures in Washington right now, Brian Haywood, you need some blood pressure intervention and to eat less red meat for being so rich? It's shocking. You look so bloated in a public setting. Do you think they want him calling Democratic lawmakers hot on social media? Do you think they want him attacking a woman who's doesn't have kids as childless? Do you think they want him telling, you know, a media figure with one of the largest followings in Washington state that she's a dollar store Ann Coulter? Like, probably not, right? And he's using his real name. So anyway, Robert Knoll, we reached out, Nicole reached out to Puget Sound Energy this morning. I didn't have high expectations because we rarely hear back from Puget Sound Energy. But they gave Nicole a prompt response, and I am going to read that for you. It's from Andrew Padula, who's their media engagement consultant. He says, the views expressed on the employee's personal social media account in no way reflect PSE's opinions. PSE has a company policy that employees are not authorized to speak on behalf of the company in any personal communications, including social media. We are reviewing this matter internally. And that's a fine response. Like, I appreciate the prompt response. I would also note that I think Robert Knoll thinks he's in a little bit of trouble. You know how I know that? He cooked his ex account. It no longer exists. Sorry, @VirtuosoBob. I think you went a step too far this time. So that gave me a little bit of joy, knowing that he had to cook his ex account where he only uses it to troll people he disagrees with politically and say horrible, horrible things about people. And I'm glad Puget Sound Energy seems to be looking into the matter. But I take this back to something I said at the beginning of this segment, you know, why do we all care about this, et cetera? One of the policies here in 2066 that Puget Sound Energy and natural gas, we just had a guest on our Sunday show, a Japanese immigrant who runs a few Japanese noodle restaurants. And he's saying, look, you know, if PSE takes away natural gas, I'm out of a job. Like, I won't have a business anymore. So this is someone who not only would he be out of, he wouldn't have a business, an immigrant to this country, his employees would be out of work. And so there are real substantial consequences to the policies that we're all discussing here, to the initiatives that we're all discussing and should be debating reasonably based on facts. Yet you have a lobbyist for Puget Sound Energy, which has one of the biggest stakes in what happens with these initiatives in November, personally attacking. And that shows you they don't have anything, right? That shows you that he doesn't have any facts, any reasonable arguments to bring to the debate. All he has are personal attacks. All he can do as the lobbyist for PSE is call Brian Haywood bloated, say I'm sad and childless and I'm a dollar store Ann Coulter. And he doesn't have any rational facts to bring to the argument. And meantime, you have people like Ryo Izama, who we had on the Sunday show, who are waiting with bated breath to see what happens in November because they might lose their livelihoods. And the other side has people like Robert Noel. I'll tell you what, I never like people losing their job. That is not something I ever advocate for. In this case, I might make an exception. Absolutely. Positively. Unfreaking believable. All right, coming up next, Kamala Harris revealed her plan to help the economy and the middle class. We'll go through it. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, highly suggest you reaching out to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Nicole, do we have that testimonial today? Okay, we'll use it tomorrow. We did a taping with an awesome lady, fan of the show, who used Wes and is literally the best spokesperson for Wes Jones I could imagine, because her experience with him was great. We love hearing that. We want to know that you're being treated well by the show sponsors, which we expect because we love all of them to bits. So sellwithwes.com. He was telling us that even though the interest rates have been a little bit shoddy, right now, there is not a lot of supply in the market. So what that means is if you're going to sell your home at some point in the next 6 months, if you list it sooner rather than later, you're going to have that competition for your listing, which is what helps you get a better price.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come up, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
Visit sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. You can start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. And Wes will give you a free market analysis. You can kind of figure out how well positioned your home is depending on where it's at. And Wes always recommends, and I recommend, check out a few real estate agents before you settle with him. But I think you'll really like what he has to offer. So sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Oh my goodness, I have been stewing all weekend. I was just waiting for Monday, because this Kamala Harris plan, I don't want somebody calling me racist because I'm mispronouncing her name, because apparently Nancy Mace did that, and now she's a racist. Kamala Harris. I never intentionally mispronounce anyone's name. Kamala Harris. So she, you know, we were waiting for her really to say her plan for anything. Up until yesterday, I don't know if it's been fixed now, the day before the DNC, she didn't have a policy tab on her website. It was just like, here's Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, and we want to be in charge of the country. I'll have to check and see if it's been updated since then. But she kept saying, I'm going to release my economic plan. And she's really, well, here's a little clip of her talking about her housing plan.
As president, I will work in partnership with industry to build the housing we need both to rent and to buy. We will take down barriers and cut red tape, including at the state and local levels. Because, you know, some corporate landlords, some of them, buy dozens, if not hundreds, of houses and apartments. Then they turn them around and rent them out at extremely high prices. And it can make it impossible then for regular people to be able to buy or even rent a home. Some corporate landlords collude with each other to set artificially high rental prices, often using algorithms in price-fixing software to do it. It's anti-competitive, and it drives up costs. I will fight for a law that cracks down on these practices. So in addition, while we work on the housing shortage, my administration will provide first-time home buyers with $25,000 to help with the down payment on a new home.
So bribery. I mean, this is similar to Joe Biden and his payoff student loan thing. There's a couple reasons why this is just utterly ridiculous. And I'm going to get to some of the other aspects of her economic proposal. You know, when she says we're going to cut red tape, I agree. One of the issues we're facing in Washington state is there's too much red tape, too many permitting delays for builders that make it so that homes aren't affordable to build. So you can't build affordable housing if it's not affordable to build. But do I really think that Democrats are interested in cutting back on government bureaucracy and red tape? I've never seen that from them, not once. We have the government bureaucracy and red tape in Washington state, and she says she's going to try to fix that. What is she going to do locally or at a state level to like change the guidelines that state lawmakers are putting down here? I mean, I don't know what control she thinks she has over that. I just find it ridiculous, really, that she is going to make the assertion that they're going to cut back on government bureaucracy. Like, Democrats love government bureaucracy. They love the money that comes from government bureaucracy. And we've seen Jay Inslee throw out these, and Bob Ferguson throw out these, oh, we're going to build 3 million new homes with no plan to do it. Like, just an artificial goal. We're going to build 3 million new homes by 2030. And they never meet any of their goals, but it sounds really good when they run for office, right? Sounds really good on the campaign trail. So I'll believe it when I see it. But that $25,000 in down payment assistance for first-time home buyers, that's nuts. That's nuts. And it's the same economic implications that just wiping away student. First of all, it's that, where are you going to get the money for that, right? And we'll talk about that momentarily. That's a lot of money, obviously. And how are you going to prove that someone's a first-time home buyer? Like, think about the intricacies of trying to figure that out, right? Like, what if, because it's a first generation also. They said, like, first generation home buyers might get more. So that was one aspect of her proposal. First generation home. How would you prove somebody was a first generation home buyer? Like, what if, like, my great grandpa bought a home, but like my grandpa and my parents didn't? What if like I had a split family and my parents were divorced and my dad bought a home, but my mom didn't? Like, what are you talking about? These things don't make any sense in
also,
practice.
Also, how is that fair? Or
it's not fair. It's the same thing with people who paid back their student loans, worked, saved diligently. It's like, okay, what if you just bought a home and you didn't get a $25,000 down payment assistance? And also there's a thought on some economists that now if home sellers know that, they're just going to jack up the price of the home $25,000 when it hits the marketplace. So none of that makes any sense. It's just a bribe. And I get it. I get it why they do it, right? Same thing with people who are crushed under the weight of student debt. Like, oh, they're going to basically like wipe 50 grand in debt from my accounts. Yeah, I guess I'll vote for them, especially if I was kind of leaning either way. Like, yeah, I'll do that. $25,000. They're trying to appeal to younger voters, right? So the really egregious one for me is the price fixing. So we can just skip past the second one and go to price fixing. So she said, this is from PBS News. After years of polling showing that Americans are worried about inflation, Harris is aiming to contain prices where they have often been most conspicuously felt. At the grocery store, she's promising to, during her first 100 days in office, send Congress proposed federal limits on price increases for food producers and grocers. Harris also is seeking new authority for the Federal Trade Commission and attorneys general in states across the country to enact steeper punishments for violators. She also wants to use use government regulators to crack down on mergers and acquisitions among large food industry businesses that the vice president argues have contributed to higher prices. So she wants price fixing, and she wants to tell retailers where to price their goods. Like, that's communist. That's going to end up in bread lines and toilet paper lines or whatever you want to call it. And also, I don't know. First of all, they know this. I want to say that. Her administration knows this, that this is a bad idea. But they're just like, what, you know, can we break through to Americans who aren't going to think this through, right? Who are struggling now, who need relief now, and we can just convince them and lie to them that this is going to work. Grocery stores have, and I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's like a 1% to 3% profit margin. They sell a lot of goods, very slim profit margins. This idea that they're out there like artificially inflating their prices is ridiculous. They have to deal with inflationary demands as well. You know, farmers, when they sell their goods or their apples in Washington State or whatever it is, like, they're price takers. And so they don't have an opportunity to really just be like, oh, we're charging way more for our apples now. They got to take what they're given. And they're given, you know, a fraction of the 1% of the profit that the grocery store is going to make. So, I mean, the idea that you have grocery stores just absolutely like price gouging is so stupid to me. It's so dumb. And you're going to put them out of business. If you cap prices artificially and they're not able to make up for their increased costs, I mean, think about all the increased costs that grocery stores have in a state like Washington. High minimum wage, right? And they just expect them to absorb the cost of that. Oh, no, what do? Well, now they have more self-checkouts and fewer employees. They just got rid of people. Is that what you really wanted? No, but they can't absorb the cost. When you bump like the minimum wage $3 an hour, they can't manufacture money out of nothing. So they just have to let people go. And so that if you're going to put a cap on prices at the grocery store, their margins are already so, so thin. What do you think they're going to do? It's so dumb to me. It's so dumb. But I think they know that. I think they know that. And they're just like, we're not going to actually do this. But like, what sounds good? What will sound good for people? Let's see here. And actually, Nicole, can you play because in order to put forth a plan like this, right, that means she's acknowledging that things are bad, right? She has to be acknowledging that the economy is bad. And we've had the Biden administration that's been saying, oh, no, like, we've been fighting inflation and blah, 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 blah. But no, in order to put out this economic plan saying we need to take all these drastic measures, she has to acknowledge that inflation and prices are up and hurting families. Here's a clip.
A loaf of bread cost 50% more today than it did before the pandemic. Ground beef is up almost 50%.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're acknowledging that it's not better now and that prices are steeper. So like, that's a good start. She was also asked the obvious question. Okay. You're promising all these things to Americans. How the hell are you going to pay for it? And as expected, she has no answer.
Can you explain how you're going to pay for those? And can you give us a sense of what other policies you want to unveil going forward?
Sure. Well, I mean, you just look at it in terms of what we are talking about, for example, around children and the child tax credit and extending the EITC. It's at $6,000 for the first year of a child's life. The return on that investment in terms of what that will do and what it will pay for will be tremendous. We've seen it when we did it in the first year of our administration. We reduced child poverty by over 50%. So that's a lot of the work. And then what we're doing in terms of the tax credits, we know that there's a great return on that investment. And when we increase home ownership in America, what that means in terms of increasing the tax base, not to mention property tax base, what that does to fund schools, again, return on investment. I think it's a mistake for any person who talks about public policy to not critically evaluate how you measure the return on investment. When you are strengthening neighborhoods, strengthening communities, and in particular the economy of those communities, and investing in a broad-based economy, everybody benefits, and it pays for itself.
Pays for itself. Let's see. Maybe if she says return on investment just one more time, the reporter will forget all about the fact that she never answered his question. Oh, pay for it? Don't worry about paying for it. We'll have a return on our investment down the road. She is getting knocked for this, not only in like traditionally conservative media, but in some that have been more favorable to Democrats. But the New York Post, their headline was great. Communism with a K. communism with a K, and that's what it is, and that's what we're going to end up with. I mean, this stuff, this kind of stuff, price fixing, all it's been tried and it has failed. So I just hope that Americans and voters are smart enough to see that it will devastate the middle class. You know, you might get some benefit from it short term, but think about what you're going to do to your kids and what you're going to do to your grandkids if not only you elect her, but if she actually moves forward with some of these policies. It'll devastate us. The Washington Post surprised me at first, and then I remember that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. Their opinion section did a story, "The Times demands serious economic ideas." And then they said, "Harris supplies gimmicks." They're calling what she's doing a gimmick, which is exactly what it is. It's a gimmick to win over voters in a close election. And, you know, I have gotten down on the Washington Post for being too soft on Democrats, but it doesn't surprise me that Jeff Bezos' Washington Post would say, "Oh, you want to artificially set retail prices? Eh, that doesn't work for Amazon. That doesn't work for Amazon Fresh. That doesn't work for Whole Foods, which we own. So we can't have you do that. So we'll excuse all these other bad policies that aren't directly impacting our bottom line. But like price fixing, that's where Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post draw the line." All right, we're going to get to your questions, comments, daily show poll coming up next. Long show today. I'm not going to apologize for it. A lot of stuff to talk about. Let's see. How many times in recent memory has your financial advisor not reacted to current events or not made a change in your investment portfolio? Now think about all the volatile events that have been happening around the world and in the U.S. over the last couple years. So your retirement, your portfolio manager ought to be monitoring everything, talking to you, keeping you in the loop, letting you know like, hey, we got global unrest or whatever it is. Here's how it's impacting your portfolio. Here are the steps we're taking, if any, to mitigate your risk. Zach Abraham, the chief investment officer at Bulwark Capital and host of the Know Your Risk Radio podcast, talks about this all the time. Risk management, in fact, is their number one focus. Bulwark Capital looks for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give you as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. It's exactly why you need Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital in your corner. Let them show you their risk management strategy and how it can protect the retirement that you've worked so hard for. And you can learn about their strategies with their free Common Sense Investing Guide. Get yours by visiting knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right, let's start with our daily subscriber show poll, which goes out about an hour before showtime to our wonderful subscribers on Patreon, Locals, and X. Do you plan on watching the Democratic National Convention this week? I gave you a few options for this because sometimes you never plan on watching something, but then you just accidentally stumble upon clips of it. So yes, no, or not intentionally. A lot of you are saying you don't plan to watch it, but might accidentally watch some of it. Paul said, "I'm not interested in lies," so he says he will not be watching it. Rick Alberts, Albers, they will say, "Nothing worthwhile or honest. I deal with enough BS. Sure don't need any Harris BS." Susan Robinson says, "I thought it would be educational to listen, but I got nauseated just reading the list of who would be speaking." Also, they started with a land acknowledgement because, of course, you've got to start with a land acknowledgement. If you're not, you just are racist. Megan says, "I'm going to catch bits like I did with the RNC, but I'm curious if they're reporting on holes in Kamala's campaign as a strategy. CNN's new concern is," that's CNN's new concern they're starting to voice. CNN has like weirdly started pushing back against some of Kamala's like old policy positions that like are totally disconnected from her current policy positions. So yeah, I'm curious because the whole RNC, they were uber critical of Donald Trump and how the RNC was being run and the speakers. Something tells me they're going to be a little less critical of the DNC and there's going to be a lot of fanfare. Bill Swick says, "I would end up screaming at the TV so much our cats would start climbing the walls to get out." So no. Yeah, but right now, 68% of people say they have no plans to watch the DNC. 10% say yes. 22% say not intentionally, but I might stumble upon some of it. All right, comments. Robin Hofstad says, "Should be a commercial on TV stating this information, noting that Ferguson is in the lead of the cover-up." I agree. This should be an issue. Dave Reichert is all over. I don't know if he has the money to be running commercials. I think people don't realize how much commercials cost. You need like $500,000 buy to air one ad in good spots like primetime, et cetera. So people, I see them all over social, like, "Dave needs to run TV ads." Bob Ferguson has like $8 million. So if you want him to run TV ads, you got to donate to his campaign. I mean, that's the bottom line. You can't just create money out of thin air. But yes, I mean, Dave Reichert on The Stump should be talking about this very issue. Nobody likes sex offenders, and nobody likes sex offenders being released into their neighborhood without proper notification. Katie Thompson says, one in seven reoffended. I think the better statement is one in seven have been caught reoffending. That is a very good very point. True. It's kind of scary mm-hmm. to think about, because one in four committed new crimes, but it could have been any crime, any mm-hmm. law violation. One in seven, a serious offense. But yeah, how many are committing crimes that we don't know about? Very good question. Krista M, conversations with your kids doesn't stop a predator from snatching them, referring to the Enumclaw parents who were told a year and a half ago, oh, we're releasing a violent sex offender into your neighborhood, but it's really your responsibility to keep your kids safe. Like, I think every parent knows that. At their core, every parent believes it's their job to keep their kids safe. But your kid should be safe at the bus stop. Your kid, and the government pushing violent predators into your community is something that makes it more difficult to keep your kids safe. And that's kind of the point that Enumclaw parents were making, right? Like, you tell us to keep our kids safe, and then you put a predator down the block from us. Like, you see how that's making that more difficult, government? It's just ridiculous. Bonnie Engel says, so disgusting, the abortion boss. Can't even grasp that one. What has the world come to? I just also, like, it's so weird, because, like, I don't want to judge women, right? Like, you don't know the circumstances someone's under. And if there's a convenient way, and they were planning to get an abortion, they're going to do the bus. But, like, walking on this very publicly placed bus and having an abortion on the bus, like, I don't know, wouldn't that just be a really uncomfortable place to go get an abortion?
They're trying to make it more comfortable, right? That's the point of it. And I think they're trying to over sexualize society, make it less
stigmatized.
Man, I don't even think it's about stigmatizing abortion and everything else. I think it's trying to take the religion, take the community out, so we all are just little government beings and we don't care about anything that's family or oriented or whatever. It's really, that's the Black Lives Matter motto, right? To take that family structure away so that nobody really cares about these things. And they're, I mean, it's so far effective until people start pushing back further.
Like, really normalizing it. Like, line up for your abortions, humans. I mean,
it's just relying on government. Yeah. Relying.
It's wild. Yeah. Sherry Richmond. Anyone supporting Bob doesn't take the time to actually vet his record. They blindly vote the Democratic ticket. I agree. I think that if you were able to get a video out that every single Washington voter had to watch before the elections, where you detailed just the facts about Bob Ferguson's record, what he's saying versus the truth, I think Dave Reichert would win a landslide. Mm-hmm. Landslide. Tegan Levine, USDA Rural Home Loan First-Time Homebuyer Program already exists. Nothing new. Yeah, there are programs out there to help first-time homebuyers. Low-income first-time homebuyers, veterans, other classifications. But this is just like, oh, crap, well, let's give you $25,000.
That's all on the taxpayers as opposed to these other things that have programs set up for it. But I also think that if you can't, I mean, I get it. It's really hard to save money for a down payment. But if it's going to be really hard to repair things on houses that when you have to save money to repair something on a house. So if you just give people money and have no incentive to actually, save money so that you can put towards the house. So save money so you can put it towards a broken furnace when that breaks, or patch the roof when that goes bad, or whatever it is. You're not teaching people how to take care of themselves. They're constantly, again, relying on government to bail them out.
And it's like we're going to have a 2-hour show today. It's fine. Yeah. Do we have any tapings? Are we pushing up against something?
No, I think we're okay.
Okay. It's like where they put the homeless, they say housing first. And then we see these images of these apartments, these low-income that are destroyed, that are filled with drugs, filth, people pooping on the floor. And it's because, you didn't do anything here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'd feel, so some of these programs, and I'll be honest that her proposal could do this. I'm not sure if it does though. I haven't seen this detail.
I don't think she knows.
Somebody just wrote that for her. But like, for instance, there are some programs where you get payment assistance and it's not a gift. Like when you sell your home, you have to pay it back. Mm-hmm. I still don't support it. That's a little less dumb, but there's also this issue of need base. Like with the student loan forgiveness, it was not assessed based on need. So you could have someone who's doing very well, and didn't need to have their student loans forgiven, had every intention of continuing to pay them back, because I said I would opt out of it if, because I have some, not a lot of student loans left. But if the government gave me an option and they wanted to pay it off, I would opt out because I just don't think that's right. And so I think I said that, or did I say, huh? I would opt out of it. But it's this, also this issue of need. But you're right. It just is, what is that teaching you?
And it's not going to help you in the long run. You're just going to become more dependent, or you'll lose the house and become, again, more dependent, because you'll just dig yourself a hole if you don't teach people how to be a homeowner.
Yeah. Diana Manning said of what you said, Nicole, your argument echoes the old give a man a fish story, right?
Of course, yes.
Right. And that's exactly what it is. And are you benefiting them in the long run or not? Mm-hmm. And look, there are some families like, look, do I wish I grew up in a family where my parents were like, hey, we saved $50,000 for your wedding and also to give you a down payment on a house.
Right.
I got lucky and I married a man who had a house. Thanks, babe. Because I know his family probably didn't help him with the house. So at some point, he had to save money. Houses were a lot less expensive back then, but he had to save money. He had to get a house. And, you know.
Or you're like me, and you had to wait till you were 40 to do it.
But, right.
You know, you save. And, like, that's the only way you can really get by in this world.
Yeah.
Unless you're relying on government.
Yeah. Or you go somewhere where a house is, like, 40 grand, and then you're like, well, my down payment's nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, back home in Minnesota, like, you can buy a house for under $100,000. I mean, if it's a starter home, right? But I would say, like, $300,000 in Minnesota, that's going to buy you a pretty damn big house. As long as you're, like, in Minneapolis proper. Like,
but the jobs probably don't pay as much.
Exactly.
I mean, there's all of these things, but you have to learn all of that, and in order to buy this, you can't just give somebody $25,000 and say, here's the house.
Yeah.
And
that's the argument I make here about people like, if you work in Seattle, you should be able to live in Seattle. Well, you can't. So, like, either you need a better job that pays more, or you're gonna have to move 30 minutes out of the city.
Right.
Like, we live 30 minutes out of the city. You live, it's a 30 minute drive in, you know,
in Everett.
Ridiculous. Sergeant Pickles on profit margins, like, look, I'm just going toward 2 hours. It's fine. Sergeant Pickles on profit margins. Margins on food is almost nothing. Costco famously makes 92% of their profits on memberships and breaks even on a lot of actual products. Let me see. Matthew Cook, she says return on investment 4 times and in terms of 3 times. When you keep saying in terms of, you're not bright.
Oh, that's her crutch.
In terms of,
so she can think of what she's going
to
say.
Like, look, I have words that are crutches too. I'm not going to say them because then I say them, you guys will be in the comments like, oh, Brandy just said her crutch.
But we're also not running for president.
Right. 100%. But you can tell, you know, that whole spiel she gave. Can you play just the first couple sentences of the video where she's explaining her housing plan again? Just because you can tell she doesn't know. Those words were just written for her. She has no idea.
You know, some corporate landlords, some of them, buy dozens, if not hundreds, of houses and apartments. Then they turn them around and rent them out at extremely high prices. And it can make it impossible then for regular people to be able to buy or even rent a home. Some corporate landlords collude with each other to set artificially high rental prices, often using algorithms in price fixing software.
I think it's the word algorithms. I think it's the word algorithms that made me think she doesn't know what she's talking about. She would never use the word algorithms.
She almost did like an air quote.
Fixing software.
Because she was quoting somebody.
Yeah.
Fixing software.
You know, you've never said anything like that your whole life. No. What are you even talking about?
Just demonizing people that work hard to own a lot of property.
It does. Okay. Are those all? Let me see. Yeah. I think those are all the comments we pulled for today. Mm-hmm. All right. We are at 1:39. Really letting you have it on a Monday. And tomorrow's show is going to be probably just as long. I'm going to give you a little pre-warning because we're also doing a follow-up on the sex offender thing. But as we wrap up today, let's get to our closing sanity check. So I played a clip earlier of Kamala Harris admitting that, yeah, prices are higher than they were when Donald Trump took office. Well, someone took that little bit and turned it into the world's easiest commercial for the former president of the United States.
A loaf of bread cost 50% more today than it did before the pandemic. Ground beef is up almost 50%.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Yep, that's about as easy as it gets. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's overtime edition of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Remember your assignment that I gave you at the top of the show today. Reach out to the Seattle Times. Ask them, why did you not feel like it was necessary to call Bob Ferguson out about bragging about keeping communities safe from these sexually violent predators? Be nice about it, but, you know, be stern with them. I think it's time that we're stern with the media for failing us so, so badly. We, of course, will never fail you, or very rarely fail you, so that's a good reason to subscribe to support our show. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. Again, just $5 a month. We will see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.